The very young lieutenant's house was definitely not very provincial. Naive as she was, she knew immediately what Savardin meant, and was angry enough at it to address Savardin in a way that was less formal than propriety demanded. "Otter's tits, cousin. No one said anything about clientage." "No one could. None of us can make contracts until we retire." Among the wealthy, clientage was a very hierarchical relationship. A patron promised certain sorts of assistance to her client, both financial and social, and a client provided support and services to her patron. These were promises that could last generations. In the oldest, most prestigious houses, the servants were nearly all the descendants of clients, for instance, and many businesses owned by wealthy houses were staffed by client branches of lower ones. "These provincial houses are ambitious," Savardin explained, voice the slightest bit condescending. "And clever as well, or they wouldn't have gotten as far as they have. She's senior to you, and you've both got years to serve yet. Grant her intimacy on those terms, let it continue, and depend on it. One of these days she'll be offering you clientage when it ought to be the other way around. I don't think your mother would thank you for exposing your house to that sort of insult." The very young lieutenant's face heated with anger and chagrin. The shine of her first adult romance suddenly gone, the whole thing turned sordid and calculating. Savardin leaned forward, reached out for the tea flask and stopped, with a surge of irritation, said silently to me, the fingers of her free hand twitching, "This cuff has been torn for 3 days." I said directly into her ear, "I'm sorry, Lieutenant." I ought to have offered to make the repair immediately, dispatched a segment of one esk to take the offending shirt away. I ought, in fact, to have mended it 3 days before. Ought not to have dressed her in that shirt that day. Silence in the cramped compartment, the very young lieutenant still preoccupied with her discomfiture. Then I said directly into Savardin's ear, "Lieutenant, the decade commander will see you at your earliest convenience." I had known the promotion was coming, had taken a petty satisfaction in the fact that even if she ordered me that moment to mend her sleeve, I would have no time to do it. As soon as she left her quarters, I started packing her things, and 3 hours later she was on her way to her new command, freshly made captain of Sword of Nathtas. I hadn't been particularly sorry to see her go. Such small things. It wasn't Savardin's fault if she had reacted badly in a situation that few, if any, 17-year-olds could have handled with aplomb. It was hardly surprising that she was precisely as snobby as she had been brought up to be. Not her fault that over my, at the time, 1,000 years of existence, I had come to have a higher opinion of ability than of breeding, and had seen more than one very provincial house rise far enough to lose that label and turn out its own versions of Savardin. All the years between young Lieutenant Savardin and Captain Savardin, they were made up of tiny moments, minor things. I never hated Savardin. I had just never particularly liked her. But I couldn't see her now without thinking of someone else. The next week at Striegan's house was unpleasant. Savardin needed constant looking after and frequent cleaning up. She ate very little, which in some respects was fortunate, and I had to work to make sure she didn't get dehydrated. But by the end of the week, she was keeping her food down and sleeping at least intermittently. Even so, she slept lightly, twitching and turning, often trembling, breathing hard, and waking suddenly. When she was awake and not weeping, she complained that everything was too harsh, too rough, too loud, too bright. Another few days after that, when she thought I was asleep, she went to the outer door and stared out over the snow, and then put on her clothes and a coat and trudged to the outbuilding and then the flyer. She tried to start it, but I had removed an essential part and kept it close. When she returned to the house, she had at least the presence of mind to close both doors before she tracked snow into the main room, where I sat on a bench, holding Striegen's stringed instrument. She stared, unable to conceal her surprise, still shrugging slightly, uncomfortable in the heavy coat, itchy. "I want to leave," she said in a voice oddly half-cowed and half-arrogant, commanding Rodchai. "We'll leave when I'm ready," I said, and fingered a few notes on the instrument. Her feelings were too raw for her to be able to conceal them just now, and her anger and despair showed plainly on her face. "You are where you are," I said, in an even tone, "as a result of decisions you made yourself." Her spine straightened, her shoulders went back. "You don't know anything about me, or what decisions I have or haven't made." It was enough to make me angry again. I knew something about making decisions and not making them. "Ah, I forget. Everything happens as Amat wills. Nothing is your fault." Her eyes went wide. She opened her mouth to speak, drew breath, but then blew it out, sharp and shaky. She turned her back, ostensibly to remove her outer coat and drop it on a nearby bench. "You don't understand," she said, contemptuous, but her voice trembled with suppressed tears. "You're not Rodchai." "Not civilized." "Did you start taking Kef before or after you left the Roch?" It shouldn't have been available in Rodchai territory, but there was always some minor smuggling station authorities might turn a blind eye toward. She slumped down onto the bench beside where she'd sloppily left her coat. "I want tea." "There's no tea here." I set the instrument aside. "There's milk." More specifically, there was fermented bove milk, which the people here thinned with water and drank warm. The smell, and taste, was reminiscent of sweaty boots. And too much of it would likely make Savardin slightly sick. "What sort of place doesn't have tea?" she demanded, but leaned forward, elbows on her knees, and put her forehead on her wrists, her bare hands palm up, fingers outstretched. "This sort of place," I answered. "Why were you taking Kef?"
"You wouldn't understand."
Tears dropped into her lap. "Try me." I picked up the instrument again, picked out a tune. After 6 seconds of silent weeping, Savardin said,
"She said it would make everything clearer."
"The Kef would?" No answer. "What would be clearer?"
"I know that song," she said, her face still resting on her wrists.
I realized it was very likely the only way she would recognize me and change to a different tune. In one region of Valsky, singing was a refined pastime. Local choral associations, the center of social activity. That annexation had brought me a great deal of the sort of music I had liked best, when I had had more than one voice. I chose one of those. Savardin wouldn't know it. Valsky had been both before and after her time.
"She said,"
Savardin said finally, lifting her face from her hands,
"that emotions clouded perception, that the clearest sight was pure reason, undistorted by feeling."
"That's not true." I'd had a week with this instrument and very little else to do. I managed 2 lines at once.
"It seemed true at first. It was wonderful at first. It all went away. But then it would wear off, and things would be the same, only worse. And then after a while, it was like not feeling felt bad. I don't know. I can't describe it. But if I took more, that went away. And coming down got less and less endurable. I'd heard the story a few times in the past 20 years.
Oh, Amat's grace, she moaned. I want to die.
Why don't you? I changed to another song. My heart is a fish hiding in the water grass, in the green, in the green. She looked at me as though I were a rock that had just spoken. You lost your ship, I said. You were frozen for 1,000 years. You wake up to find that the Roch has changed. No more invasions. A humiliating treaty with a Presger. Your house has lost financial and social status. No one knows you or remembers you or cares whether you live or die. It's not what you were used to, not what you were expecting out of your life, is it? It took 3 puzzled seconds for the fact to dawn. You know who I am. Of course I know who you are. You told me, I lied. She blinked, tearily, trying, I supposed, to remember if she had or not. But her memories were, of course, incomplete. Go to sleep, I said, and laid my fingers across the strings, silencing them. I want to leave, she protested, not moving, still slumped on the bench, elbows on her knees. Why can't I leave? I have business here, I told her. She curled her lip and scoffed. She was right, of course. Waiting here was foolish. After so many years, so much planning and effort, I had failed. Still, go back to bed. Bed was the pallet of cushions and blankets beside the bench where she sat. She looked at me, half sneering still, and contemptuous, and slid down to the floor and lay, pulled a blanket over herself. She wouldn't sleep at first, I was sure. She would be trying to think of some way to leave, to overpower me, or convince me to do what she wanted. Any such planning would be useless until she knew what she wanted, of course. But I didn't say that. Within the hour, her muscles slackened and her breathing slowed. Had she still been my lieutenant, I would have known for certain she slept, known what stage of sleep she was in, known whether or not she dreamed. Now I could only see externals. Still wary, I sat on the floor leaning against another bench and pulled a blanket up over my legs. As I had done every time I'd slept here, I opened my inner coat and put my hand on my gun, leaned back and closed my eyes. 2 hours later, a faint sound woke me. I lay unmoving, my hand still on my gun. The faint sound repeated itself, slightly louder. The second door closing. I opened my eyes, just the slightest bit. Savardin lay too quiet on her pallet. Surely she had heard the sound as well. Through my eyelashes, I saw a person in outdoor clothes. Just under 2 meters tall, thin under the bulk of the double coat, skin iron gray. When she pushed back her hood, I saw her hair was the same. She was certainly not a Nilter. She stood watching me and Savardin for 7 seconds, and then quietly stepped to where I lay and bent to pull my pack toward her with one hand. In the other hand, she held a gun, pointed steadily at me, though she seemed not to know I was awake. The lock baffled her for a few moments, and then she pulled a tool out of her pocket, which she used to bypass the lock, quite a bit more quickly than I had anticipated. Her gun still trained on me, and glancing occasionally at still motionless Savardin, she emptied the pack. Spare clothes, ammunition but no gun, so she would know or suspect that I was armed.